So welcome to this afternoon's session. This is the last session of the conference. My name is James Batley, and I'm delighted to be chairing this session on the fascinating and evolving topic of faith and gender. We've got four wonderfully qualified speakers with us this afternoon. I've got good news and bad news on our first speaker, the Reverend Dr. Cliff Bird, unfortunately isn't able to be with us, but fortunately his place is ably being taken by Bronwyn Fraser from Uniting World, a colleague of Cliff's who's worked very closely with him. Our second speaker will be Helen Vavia from Papua New Guinea, from the United Church Development Unit. She will be followed by the Reverend Serena Lomaloma from the Anglican Diocese of Polynesia in Fiji, so Wulawinaka, Reverend Serema. And last but not least, Abigail Howe-Will from World Vision Australia will be speaking to us. Now, I think each of the speakers has been allotted 15 minutes, and what we're going to do is run one after the other without questions so that we do leave hopefully 20 minutes at the end for some questions. Otherwise, we're never going to have any time at the end for questions. So without further ado, Bronwyn, take it away.
Great, thank you. Can everyone see the PowerPoint clearly enough? Okay, awesome. So, thank you for joining us today and for engaging in a discussion or a journey on engaging with faith-based organisations in the Pacific to focus on gender equality and anti-violence. Now, as we said, Cliff isn't here. Cliff's one of our key theologians. He's a Solomon Islander theologian. I'm the program manager, so we work very closely together, and I have learned enormous amounts sitting at Cliff's feet, so I will impart some of that today. So just a little bit of background. I work for Uniting World, and Uniting World is the overseas partnership agency of the Uniting Church in Australia. We work in genuine partnership with Pacific churches to implement locally initiated and locally directed development programs. And one of the things, listening to some of the presentations today, as we go through, I'll do some translating of language. So with churches, we've heard a lot about collaborations. So in church speak, we talk about being ecumenical. Same deal. So we work quite ecumenically or in coalition. And we are accredited with DFAT and signatory to the Act for Code of Conduct. I put that there just to clarify, we're not a church agency that goes and converts people. Just to make that real clear. In the Pacific, if we look at the Pacific context, 95% generally across the Pacific will self-identify as being Christian and adhere to one of the denominations. In the Pacific at times, the kind of joke is multi-faith is which Christian denomination do you belong to? So that's the context in which we work. Fiji is not quite at that percentage, obviously, but more broadly across the Pacific, we're looking at around 95%. Now, just a bit of a breakdown to give a bit of an idea of the kind of numbers of populations that is across the different countries. So you'll see Fiji obviously being having a bit more variation, but the other Pacific countries, and these are mostly our partner countries, the level of population and the population identifying as Christian is very, very close. And so when we're engaging in a predominantly Christian context, it makes a lot of sense to engage with Christianity and to do so in an effective and efficient way. And one of the things we've heard a lot also about relationship, being a church organisation ourselves, we already have a foundation for that relationship. And for some of the churches in the Pacific, the Uniting Church in Australia or its predecessors, the Methodist Church, etc., have had relationships with the churches in the Pacific for about 100 years. So we're building on strong relationship. Now, this is the fun bit. So up here, what I've got are some quotes that we've had from ministers and church populations, or people in church populations, and the biblical quotes or biblical verses that are used to support the thinking, support the attitudes. So this one was after a workshop in Tonga by a minister who now conceded, yes, he would need to get his wife's permission before he beat her. But that's supported by the fact that wives must submit to their husbands, and he is the head of the house. So he has that responsibility of maintaining. She has the responsibility of obeying. And Ephesians, I've even put the Bible verse there if you want to look it up. This one was when I was working in Solomon Islands with the Women's Fellowship of the United Church. And we did some work around gender-based violence, and all the women conceded that no, violence was not acceptable. They conceded that, yes, women and men were equal. But when asked, could they leave a violent relationship for safety reasons, they said, no, that would be breaking our marriage vow. And again, Bible verse used to promote and support that. And I was also told by one of the older women that, it's a verse in the Bible, if Cliff was here, he'd know. But it's something about, you know, suffering brings perseverance, and perseverance brings character, and character brings something else. And so it was like, so it's okay for us to live in violence. And so these are the theologies that we're engaging with in Pacific churches. This is one of my personal non-favourites. If a minister is involved in causing abuse, they would suspend the minister, that's nice, but they would pastorally care for the minister so that he didn't do it again. But the victim or the survivor is told, you must forgive and forget. Because as Jesus tells us, we must forgive. And so you can see how the underlying biblical belief systems can actually reinforce violence and reinforce oppression. And that's kind of like the, you know, the downside. And when we look at culture, if we're wanting to address behaviour, we can't just focus on behaviour and values. Because if we're not addressing what underlines those values, then it can't be sustainable. Because if ultimately people believe, or ultimately a husband believes, he's the head of his household, his wife must obey him, and if she doesn't, it is his responsibility to discipline her, then addressing violence is not going to be a sustainable... just focusing on behaviour is not going to be sustainable widely. So don't read all this, I'll go through it. So... one of the programs that Uniting World's running, and it's an innovative program, and it's called Partnering Women for Change. And so these are just some of the key ideas with this program. It was designed, and the design was directed by the voices of women in churches. So all our partner churches have women's fellowship organisations. They are strong, they are active, but they often don't have voice into the church decision making. They get told what to do rather than speaking into church decision making. So partnering with the women gives the Women's Fellowship space to make those decisions, and then we partner with the church to implement or enable them to implement those decisions. It has a theological mechanism for engagement. We engage with the theology. We talk Bible. One, we're a church, so it's kind of okay with that. But two, if we don't talk about theology and we don't talk about belief systems, then we're not going to see transformation. And churches kind of go from the top level, so they're nationwide, and they also speak into how family happens. And so it's the whole gamut of Pacific society. We use a rights-based approach, but we don't use rights-based language. For a lot of churches, rights-based language is seen as external, imposed, Western. So we talk about human dignity. Human dignity afforded to all people as created equally in the image of God. So, basically, human rights afforded to all people as being human. And so it's the same concept, but when you talk about dignity and in the image of God, you actually engage with church understanding and church culture and language. And what we get, rather than a wall, is an open door. We're collaborative. We are a small organisation. We're not designed to do it all. Thank goodness for that. And so we work very collaboratively with the CAN network, and we're really good at naming things ridiculously. So we've got the CAN network. The CAN is the Church Agencies Network in Australia. So all the churches, development organisations, we work together. And we work ecumenically, in collaboration or coalition with churches within the Pacific. So we work, but not only that, we're now working more and more with secular CSO organisations in the Pacific who recognise that a rights-based language is not getting them anywhere. And so they're engaging with us to learn about a theological language and a theological approach to be able to engage with government, policy, law. And also, we don't have crisis centres or anything like that, because Fiji Women's Crisis Centre does it really well. The Vanuatu Women's Centre is really strong. There's House of Sarah in Fiji. So we kind of build a bridge between those and enable and empower churches to overcome the stigma that is attached so that women can get help. We work at a Pacific regional level, establishing strong ecumenical networks across denominations and countries. Then the country coalition level, ecumenically again, and then with our partner churches. And what we've learnt really recently is also the importance of modelling. So if we're going to stand up and talk about, and it's not me, it's Cliff, but if he's going to stand up and talk about gender equality in the home and in the church, his wife, who is also highly qualified, often will work alongside him. And she will present, and he will be the gopher to get the stuff that she needs. Now, that in a Pacific context, for a reverend doctor of status, is a really powerful thing. So here's a bit of a Bible study, briefly. So this is a bit of an example of how we engage with some of the messages within the Bible. So you've got Ephesians 5:22, and even if you're not Christian, you know this one. This is the wives. I keep going, husbands, submit to your wives. Don't know where that came from. Wives, submit to your husbands. Husbands, head of the house. And so that is the verse that people, that ministers and churches will cite. The verse before that, I don't know if anyone's heard of that one, but it says, husbands and wives submit to one another as in Christ. So the first verse of that section is equality. And so, you know, it's convenient. I don't want to talk about that one. Let's go with the status quo. Let's support patriarchy. And so we bring it back and we go, this is the foundation of what God was talking about. This is the foundation. Now, on top of that, we look at the context in which the Bible verse was written. So it was a heavily patriarchal context. So men were the head of the house, to the point of men owned their wives just like they owned the cattle. Women didn't get educated. Their role was to produce male heirs and keep the husband's reputation good. And so by looking at that, we say, okay, so Paul, who's the author of this, couldn't actually say outright without being hung, it's totally equal. But he says, okay, wives, yep, submit to your husband. And then for the rest of the whole passage, which is about another seven verses, it says, and husbands, this is the way you need to respect your wives. And so the whole passage, if you take the whole section, it actually says, yeah, okay, wives, respect and honour your husbands. Husbands, do the same, and this is what that looks like into that context. And so it's founded on equality, and then it spells that out. And so what we're really keen to do is to move away from the one Bible verse justification to go, let's actually reinterpret this, looking at it from a holistic perspective. And that's where Cliff is phenomenal. And we don't just do one or two verses. You know, there's the Genesis 1, everyone's created in God's image, equal, that works. The Genesis 2 creation, women the rib, yeah, that's problematic often for churches. But it's not women were taken from the foot underneath. Women were taken from alongside. Anyway, I'll get off that. And so what we've got is a suite of resources, a foundational framework paper that spans the whole context of the Bible. It looks at the context it was written in, the messaging, and what that means for the context that people live in. And then it takes some significant Bible passages and enables group discussion. And we're in the process now of simplifying these down for youth groups, Sunday schools, women's fellowship, people who don't have formal literacy, who use functional literacy, so that it becomes accessible across the breadth of the church. And the foundation or framework paper is also a really good document for a basis of theological school curriculum. So getting it into the training colleges for ministers as well. Now, just going to talk a little bit, very briefly, about the CPP, and Helen's going to pick up on that a little bit later, or next. But in 2014, and this is just a bit of a success story, Uniting World facilitated training in the gender equality theology, with the Church Leaders Council, seven leaders of seven mainline churches in Papua New Guinea. And we had this discussion around this radical new look at theology. Now, these are conservative churches, and there were some really radical theological statements made. We were scared. At the end of it, one of the ministers stood up and apologised to every woman in the room and said, "We did this. We take responsibility." We talked to the head of the United Church, who was quite conservative in comparison, and he said, "We have to engage in this. We have to make a change. It's biblical." And so you can see that the foundation in the belief system is the motivator and the key for change. And just a few other... So Vanuatu, the VCC, is on board. Vanuatu Christian Council, ecumenical, they're on board. Solomon Islands, SECA, they're on board with the Church Agencies Network. And in Fiji, we're working with the Fiji Women's Crisis Centre and the Disability Forum, and working on men and men's engagement and men's responsibility.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. With a bit of a romp to the line. Yeah. All right, if I could invite Helen. You can sit down, you can stand up.
Thank you. I've been a pro geta. My presentation will draw my experience in facilitating churches or the partner churches in working together with a common goal for the network in PNG.
So one day I step out of the office, and then I witness a woman being beaten. So I helped this woman, but, you know, when you make a fire to boil hot water or cook your food, you need a lot of firewood so that it heats up. So one person, to move that, bring that issue to the government or to the community, is not that effective. So I have to call my colleagues from the other churches to come and help. So with CPP, it's like that. We have seven mainland churches. So we have the United Church in PNG, the Catholics, Anglican, Salvation Army, Evangelical Lutheran Church, Baptist, and the Seventh-day Adventist. So the seven mainland churches in PNG, together with the seven Australian agencies, we work together in this Church Partnership Program, or CPP, which is an Australian aid-funded program which started in 2004. And we are now in the transition period. This is the last 5 months before we move into the third phase. So it shows a relationship that was not built overnight, but it took us 10 years. So it also shows that churches in the Pacific, sometimes we have our own space. You know, we're very protective of our space. But with this CPP, it has built that relationship not only with donors, but also church-to-church relationship. And it has built that confidence that we have with each other. So if you see two church leaders from Papua New Guinea and you ask them which church you're from, and one says, I'm the moderator of the United Church, and the other says, I'm the head of Catholic. But you see them joking around. There's something you won't find in churches in other countries, but that's happening in PNG. And there's something really good about the church partnership program that we have. So it starts at that leadership level, and it also comes down to us at the program level. So I work for the development unit of the United Church, and I am the gender person for the church. And United Church is across PNG in all the regions, in all the provinces, as well as our other colleagues or our other partners, the other six partners. So I don't know how many members our other partners have, but in PNG we have over 400,000. So that's our membership. But if you add the number of other churches, we reach almost across the country. That's one of the benefits that CPP brings across. So I guess the question that we are all thinking about is, how do all these churches with their different beliefs and their different values and principles, you know, work together to promote gender equality in PNG? So Bronwyn brought up some of the points. So gender has always been something that the churches have been doing, but we don't really use the language gender. You know, so we have a women's fellowship who conduct training for women. We have our men's fellowship. We all do activities that bring us together, but we never called it gender. We never realized that there was a term to it. But then we are now in that, and there is also a shift in mindset for the churches now. And we are all working towards to achieving that as a family, not just one church, but as a family. So we started talking about the gender strategy, the CPP gender strategy, because as Bronwyn has said, we are identified by a church, and then our culture is very strong. And in PNG, it becomes very challenging with all the different values and beliefs. And then we have more than 800 languages. So I can speak a language, but two villages away from me, they speak a completely different language. So it became more challenging bringing in our cultural norms and, you know, beliefs together with our Christian beliefs and principles. So we started talking about a gender strategy, which took us some time, but we eventually had it launched. And the goal of our strategy, the CPP gender strategy, is for churches to contribute visibly, practically, and consistently to building a society that enhances gender equality and thriving relationships in PNG. So there are three pillars. We also had challenges with this document. So it's 196 pages. Uh-huh. And you get this document and give it to a church leader. So for United Church, I gave it to the moderator and his the bishops, and they said, can you please simplify it for us? So I thought it was only the United Church, but then we had the SDAs with the same response, the Anglicans. So we said, oh, so our friends, our Australian agencies assisted us in simplifying it down to a one-page document, which wasn't that easy, but thankfully they did that. So Uniting Well was part of, they played a very major role in that as well. So with that one-page document that we gave to our leaders, we had three pillars. So we had sharing it, living it, and collaborating. So those were the three pillars. And under sharing it, we have new knowledge on gender equality is built, mainstreamed, and shared among the CPP practitioners and partners within and among the churches and communities. And then we had one or two action points for the churches. For living it, we looked at gender inequality in governance and also addressing family violence and service delivery. But I will be touching on collaboration. I will elaborate more on collaboration. So we had 2 points on collaboration. And the first one was strengthening the capacity of MI to engage with gender-related issues. I myself is not an academic. I'm not a researcher, nor a theologian. But for the MI stands for Melanesian Institute in PNG. So that's the institution in PNG that does social research, and that's the institution that also informs all the church leaders. So some of the things that we do, they are based on research that are done by the Melanesian Institute, to which all the, not just the 7 partnerships, partners that I just mentioned in CPP, but other churches that are not part of CPP are also members to this Melanesian Institute. And that's where the, our leaders go and have their meetings, and they're informed on some of the social issues. And the other thing is the launching of the Theology of Gender Equality. So that's the one. And that's the one that Bronwyn was also talking about. Sorry, this is the only copy, but I think we should have... Thank you. So, in 2014, as Bron mentioned, there was a discussion, and all the church leaders embraced that discussion. So they asked Reverend Dr. Cliff and Reverend Seth Rosser from Uniting Well to draft a theology for us, the CPP, which they did in November 2014. So we had the forum in October, and in November 2014, they sent us a draft. So that was a very quick job. And the challenge was left to myself to bring together all the churches and look at this document. So this is only, but it was a little bit big. But then, you know, we're going towards the Christmas period, and we're winding down, and church leaders are going for their holidays. So nobody's interested in coming to meet in PNG. We're already in the holiday mood. So I had to do up a 6 months timetable. That was just my assumption, that in 6 months we will be able to produce this document. But it took us 1 year, 8 months before it was launched. So it was launched in April 2016. I think you were there to also witness. But it came with its challenges. It took us that long. But I think this is something that we have gone too far, and it's something that will bring all the churches, the 7 mainland churches, and we are also using this, as well as our the church leaders, to also strengthen the capacity of our other colleagues or our other churches in the country. So we are starting with the CPP family, but we are also looking at those that are outside of the partnership. Yeah, so it was launched, and we are now planning on conducting training not only for United Church, but also for our other church partners, the other six partners. And also, and we are targeting our church leaders, but also this training will go down to the community level. Yeah. So those are our two entry points, and as well as our staff in the office. So it shows how churches work together, and then we also believe, as with the mind shift, that the shift in mindset that we have, we also believe that gender equality is a way of good governance that delivers people from the overbalance that has been created over the years. And most of the time, churches are always, you know, seen as the ones that contribute or add to that overbalance in people. So this is our way of working together to contribute to this issue. Yeah, I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Helen. That's a great story. So if I could invite the Reverend Serena, your turn. And I think you'll just be sitting there as well.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Thank you. Not too long ago, one of the members of our church came to see us, to share with us the pain and the torment that that she had been subjected to for a number of years, and came to see the church leader. And you know, the fact that she came to reveal this was quite astounding in itself. But the fact that the abuser, her husband, was a priest, was even more unfathomable for us. How does a church respond to that? You know, when you are confronted with a survivor, a victim of violence, but also the fact that the perpetrator is a clergy person. And that's the reality we have to deal with. But I think fortunately, because the church already, we already have a policy on zero tolerance on violence, which had been passed way back in 2013, that we were able to address this, not only to be beside the victim and the supporter, the survivor of violence, but also to see how we could deal with the perpetrator of violence. And so today, I just want to reaffirm the topic which was given to us, which is that if we have to bring about transformation in, you know, in Fiji, it's necessary to engage the churches, because the church, the Christians, number 55, about 53% in Fiji, as was shared already by Bronwyn. The majority of the people in Fiji are Christians. And, you know, statistics show that, you know, the number of people who are in the prisons, the bulk of them are Christians. Those who are, you know, those who are the perpetrators of violence, the majority of them, well, almost all of them are Christians. And the victims, the survivors, they are Christians. And so, you know, the church cannot not be engaged. If we have to bring about transformational change, the churches must be involved. Churches always been viewed negatively, and that we are, you know, the church is the gatekeeper. that we resist change, you know, because of our theology, our doctrines, our practices, you know, the structures that we have, and so we are looked on as gatekeepers. You know, that we are accused that we are, you know, the complicit with in the perpetuation of gender-based violence because we don't speak out, we don't make a stand, we don't correct the biblical texts that are being used, you know, that are really discriminatory to women. And in the baseline survey that we did in, that we carried out in 2015, the same quotation, same views that that Bronwyn shared with you, we also found that. You know, 56% of those who were part of the baseline survey said that men are the head of households, and they agree that that should be the model for the leadership, you know, of families. They also said that when confronted with violence, 76% of them said that they would offer faith-based coping mechanisms, strategies, you know, pray with them, go and read the Bible. Some said that, you know, the woman should submit. And so we are aware that this is the general view that people have in the church, those who are sitting in the pews. And so the church has taken it upon itself, you know, to address gender-based violence. I mean, the good news that I want to share with you is that in 2013, the Anglican Church, the Diocese of Polynesia, broke the silence. And that was when there was a resolution on zero tolerance on violence, gender-based violence, not only in the home, in the communities, and in our schools, and in the church. And so since then, the church has made it a point of putting together a strategy on how to actually implement this. And so today I just want to share that with you. You know, the whole of church approach in dealing with this, but also the others. The second part to my topic that was given to me was, you know, the church addressing inequality in the church. And so I'd like to share with you also the good news about how we were able to do that. That it took us from 2011 to 2015 to actually change the legislation of the church, so that when the parliament sits, when synod sits in every 2 years, we have an equal membership of male and female. And that took us from 2011 to 2015 to do that. It meant actually looking into the church structure and changing the legislation. And I don't think you'd find that in any part of the world where the church parliament has an equal number of male and female sitting there. Mm-hmm. I mean, we celebrate that. Mm-hmm. It took us a long time to do that. And it meant being very, very strategic about what we did and really engaging men and women to bring this about, clergy persons and lay people to do it. And so today I'll share the two good news that, you know, that I share with you today. I mean, engaging churches to bring about, you know, transformational change. And so for us, it's been really, it's a whole church approach. Because like we are the Anglican Church, the Anglican Church covers Anglicans in Fiji, in Tonga, in Samoa, in American Samoa, and we also have an Episcopal unit in Aotearoa, New Zealand. So when I talk about these changes that are happening, it's actually covering those countries where the Diocese of Polynesia, where the Diocese of Polynesia covers. And so for us, the whole church approach that we have is looking into our structures, in looking into our legislations, our canons, and the practices that we have, and how can we change those. Looking into the teachings of the Bible, because as you know, Bronwyn has said, and also Helen, this is really the foundation for us. You know, if you want to bring about behavioral change, you really have to look at our faith, because this is what actually influences our attitude, our view of the world, the way we do things. You know, if that's what's been drummed into you, that, you know, the woman must submit, you know, the woman you actually came out of the rib, that is what is going to, you're going to live with that. That's what you go through life with. And so we go back to the teachings of the Bible. And the third one is, you know, we have a preventative strategy and also a response. The other one is working with children in the children's ministry, with young people, with men, with women. And also our schools. We have 11 schools in the Diocese of Polynesia. And also engaging the clergy people, because clergy persons, they are the ones who actually preach. You know, they are the ones who conduct premarital counseling, where they're talking with, you know, the couple about their household, about the home that they're going to be setting up. And so, you know, we must have our foothold in there about talking with the clergy, how to, when they do counseling with the couple who are going to be married, you know, that they are equal partners. You know, you can't be, as Bronwyn said, like, you're not going to, if you're going to be abusing your wife, I mean, your wife really doesn't have to stay with you. You're the one who's actually broken the promise, not her, if she actually leaves. And also addressing the schools. So the whole church strategy, whole church approach is actually covering all this. And so we, when we're trying to address the gender-based violence, in our preventative strategy, we not only are doing the training where we are talking about the biblical texts with lay people, but also with the clergy. And then so we do the workshop for both the lay leaders, the clergy, the young people, the men and the women. We also have the a production of a Christian education curriculum, and that's where we put in about equal and respectful relationships. So in the primary schools, we're already including this curriculum in there, so that when the children are growing up, they're learning about this. So it's not only a Christian education curriculum in the primary school and secondary school. We are going to be beginning with children's ministry. And so it, you know, we cover all the age groups. And so for prevention strategy, they are the workshops, they are the curriculum that's been produced, and then we have the services that we provide, our response, where we provide services to those who are the victims and the survivors of violence. We have the House of Sarah, and that's where we have our counselors, who we don't call counselors. There's so much baggage attached to that. We call them Ndowingarawi, which is a vernacular term. And in the community, we also have the Sarah Carers. Sarah Carers are the first point of contact. And so, because we found the women, you know, they don't want to come to an urban center. They would rather that, you know, there's somebody out there in the parish to actually help, who might listen to them. So we do have Sarah Carers in the communities. They are the referral people in the community. And when they come to them, they can then, if they cannot provide, they are the ones who provide a listening ear, a helping hand, and a warm heart. And from there, they can then refer them to the, you know, Fiji Women's Crisis Center or the other providers in Fiji. And then we have, as I said before, the production of our Christian curriculum. But apart from this, we don't only work within the church, Anglican Church. We also have our ecumenical partnership. In Fiji, in the House of Sarah, we have the Christian Network Talanoa. You know, I was sitting yesterday listening to all the stories about coalitions. We do have a network. It's an informal network where we bring in those people from the women and men from the churches who are working in this area, and we have our monthly meetings, so we talk about gender-based violence, etc. And from there, we then moved on. A new thing we did last year was we went to the Fiji Council of Churches, and which has seven member churches there, and they were able to speak with one voice. I brought the posters with me because we only produced this poster last week. And it's a head of the Methodist Church, head of the Anglican Church, the Roman Catholic Church, the Baptist, Salvation Army, where it is giving the same message that gender-based violence is a sin. And so that came out in the TV. It was also an ad that went on the in the cinemas. And then we've now put out the posters of the leaders so that we can give it out to the churches. And it's them speaking about, you know, how wrong it is if you are doing this. And so the second one that I want to share is about leadership, addressing inequality. Actually, the phrase that we use is, you know, we are affirming God's call to women and men in church leadership. And that is through ordination. We started ordination in 1970 with one person. Now women, there are about 30 women clergy in the Diocese of Polynesia. And then when we talk about the women in decision-making body, as I said earlier, from 2011 till 2013, we were able to change the legislation that actually governed the membership of Synod. And so now it is there. The legislation actually says that there must be equal membership between men and women. And so that was achieved in 2015. It took us 3 synods to do it. It was achieved in 2015. And so this year is another synod where we are going to be address the membership of standing committee. And it really is working. You know, the church is working with men and women together, because the men will be the advocates in change. So that when we have our synod in May this year, we will be able to, when we do elections, we will be able to bring about the change of membership of standing committee. And so, I just want to share the good news with you. Yeah. There are a lot of lessons that we've learned from this, and policy implications, and perhaps that will come during the question time.
Thanks, Sarema. And now, Abigail. And hopefully we can pull up your help.
Okay.
I'm impressed to see everyone here. It's the last session, so thanks for sticking with us. I'm Abigail Howell. I work with World Vision in Pacific and Timor-Leste and managing programming that we do for gender-based violence prevention through churches. One approach we take is through churches. So kind of a repeat of what we've been hearing, just to solidify in your brains that working with churches, working through Christian networks in the Pacific makes sense. They're very broad, they have far reach, and often in places where World Vision is working, where it's very remote, churches are even working in more remote places. So they're able to reach out to places that other groups don't go to, can't go to, and they have influence. And so World Vision is working in PNG, Vanuatu and Solomon Islands, so I gave the statistics of the percent of Christian populations there. It's very high, and it's a salient identity for many people. They place high value on religious ideas, on religious leaders, what they say, and religious directives. It's a very strong identity. And kind of in contrast to that, in these places, there's high prevalence of gender-based violence as well. Up to 2/3 of the population of women are experiencing violence in these places. So it's a big challenge there. Just kind of getting into World Vision's work, we've worked with religious populations before, kind of realized how well it worked to work with religious communities to address HIV and AIDS. And we worked with the Christian AIDS Bureau in South Africa to develop materials to talk about really difficult issues with church leaders and help them think through how their theologies already address issues like AIDS and providing care for people who are stigmatized. And so from that, we've moved into areas of sexual reproductive health with faith leaders addressing those issues, child protection, gender equality, and gender-based violence. And in 2011, we started to pilot the work of working with faith leaders to address gender-based violence in Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands. And then shortly after, and shortly after, we started in Vanuatu because we really think gender inequality and gender identities, they're formed by many groups. And in the Pacific, religious leaders have a place in forming gender identities. And they're often used, religious teaching is used to justify intimate partner violence. And so we did an evaluation in 2015. It was after a 3-year project cycle just to see how far messages would go from church leaders. So church leaders said, we're talking about gender-based violence in the churches. They're, you know, closer church communities that our pastors are talking about gender and gender-based violence, but we wanted to see if those messages were going out into the communities. And so after a 3-year cycle, in 2015, still about 77% of the population said that man is the boss in the family and that women should submit to men. And that was the question was around even if violence is involved. And 73% of both women and men said that they agreed with that statement. And then we recently did a baseline survey in 2 provinces in Solomon Islands, and 47% of the community said they believe that the Bible teaches that men are superior to women. And around that, too, some of the structures of the religious structures reinforce social ideologies that are patriarchal. And so just we've been wanting to try to work with that and address some of those issues. This is, again, just reinforcing why working with churches makes sense, because in the Pacific, there's so many organizations that are religiously based, connected to churches, providing some of the only care to women and children who experience violence. So in Solomon Islands, the Christian Care Center is connected to the Anglican Church, and they're one of the few organizations that are providing shelter to women and children who experience violence. So the church is filling in spots where, you know, governments maybe don't have the capacity to support that, or whatever reason they're not providing services. The church is providing services. And women's groups connected to churches, as you've heard, they do so much already. They are responding to issues. And in Solomon Islands in 2015, there was a flood, and the government was having a hard time providing food to people that had evacuated. And the women's group connected to the SDA church, they responded. They were the ones providing food. So church networks are strong and can do a lot if they're mobilized and have the knowledge and capacity and are given the space to respond. And then church leaders have pre-established roles in communities, and especially in remote communities, they're the ones that are providing initial care. So when there's not services involved or they're not close enough, church leaders and chiefs are responding. And so they're sometimes the first point of contact, or the pastor's partner is the first point of contact for women and children who experience violence. So as World Vision was kind of establishing why we work with churches and looking through how do we do it, recognizing that, as Brownon said, using rights-based language, like explicitly stating rights-based principles, doesn't connect. It's important to support insider or the knowledge, the ways people understand the world, to speak through that language. So using emic epistemologies to discuss issues that are difficult about gender and things like that. So it's important to use the language and worldview that churches and church leaders are functioning out of. And so in our response, we've created spaces. We just kind of come together, have church leaders come and talk about the passages that they've mentioned of, you know, what does it mean that men is the head of the household, and deconstructing some of those things in safe learning spaces where people can say outrageous to me things, but it's safe, where they can process and learn new theologies even, and highlight theologies that promote gender equality and nonviolence and action when there is violence. So we've been in a process of evaluating our theory of change, of if we work with faith leaders and churches to address gender and gender-based violence, it will have broader effects in communities because they're part of forming gender ideologies. And so in the last 2 years, we've had three different evaluations of projects. I'm just going to highlight two. All three found that working with faith leaders and churches to address violence is an appropriate approach in the Pacific, which is significant for us because we're looking, do we continue this approach, do we not? And all three found that it was appropriate. In an evaluation with the ANU in 2015, the researchers found that, sorry, I have to go to my notes because I have more here. People were moving towards recognizing women's rights and nonviolence, and that church leaders were participating and bringing women into decision-making in their churches. And men in general inside churches, so that were loosely connected to the churches, were more open to talking about gender equality and gender-based violence. And women were becoming more outspoken about support services and their need for support services. And then there was an obvious commitment from church leaders to bring about change in this area. And last year, we did an evaluation with the University of Queensland, and it was across 30 communities in the Solomon Islands, in rural Solomon Islands. And one significant finding that we had, it was all, most of it was through qualitative research, looking through stories of people to find common themes of change and to a point of saturation. So the same theme was coming up multiple times. And one of the themes that came out was that faith leaders and churches were helping take away the places people hide. So there was one particular story of a police officer that said, as church leaders talk about these issues, then perpetrators can't hide behind the law, the formal law, and they can't be hide behind the law of God, because now church leaders are saying, actually, it's not appropriate. And so the perpetrators don't have places to hide to validate their behaviors. And women that were interviewed reported being able to talk about violence inside the home more openly. So that's a huge, a significant impact for them. And young women were saying they were feeling, gaining more confidence and the ability to speak in public, and especially in church spaces. And so those were kind of the three main themes that came out from the research. And with all of this, it's been a hurdle to find how is working with church leaders affecting social norm change. And because social norm change is not linear, it's pretty all over the place, and even amongst the same person, they may have one belief here that's conflicting with this belief here, so it's really hard to measure. Some religious leaders and traditions don't necessarily respond well to deconstructing power relationships inside the church or inside families, and that can be either from a structural level or just an individual church leader level, and that's a big hurdle and something that I don't think it's impossible to overcome, but it is a challenge. And then not all traditions are the same, so some religious traditions will more easily talk about gender equality and nonviolence. It seems like, just from experience, people are more willing to talk about nonviolence, but then talking about gender equality is a little bit more difficult. It's a little trickier. But some traditions are more open to that and moving to address, as we've heard, to institutionalize gender equality and theologies around gender equality. And one of the big hurdles that we're finding is there's uncomfortable links between some women's organizations, service providers, church leaders, and church communities. It's not across the board. There's some places that are working really well together, but sometimes the language and perception that there's competing goals can be a hurdle for groups to work with, either for women's groups to work with churches or vice versa. And that's something that I think really needs to be addressed, and I think maybe just needs more time, but it can be a big hurdle that will limit access to services and resources for women and girls. And then the last thing is, as people experience change, especially coming from a feminist perspective, the change they describe may not sound very significant or maybe difficult to reconcile with feminist ideologies or feminist ideas of how change should look. And that's something it's hard to identify, like, okay, as they say this, these words, what change does that mean? Because it's maybe not, as a researcher, it's maybe not a researcher's background, or as a program person, you may not, you may be going for different changes that you don't know if they're reflected in the language that they use. So just a few steps forward. In order to mitigate backlash of as we work with churches, it's important for us to know all the church structures, how they govern, how they make decisions, because if as people interact with these difficult issues, if you don't work through the church system well, you'll create backlash that will be bad. The last thing I want to highlight is that in any of these initiatives, it's important that women and girls are the litmus test. So finding ways to measure the change that women and girls experience is of the utmost importance, and that I think that should be something that's really in any of the initiatives should be researched, and just making sure that they're the ones who name and are also increasingly leading the changes that are occurring. So, okay, that's it. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Abigail. Now that leaves us with a bit over 15 minutes for questions. The quota is one question per person, so please don't load up with multiple questions if you...